everyone, and welcome to another brand new episode of the
Geek. It's not gonna happen. It's not gonna happen.
Damn it.
What is, the 1 week,
it's
the
soon one as I was gonna say it.
I was ready for it.
Were you ready?
Let's okay.
Do it. All right. Let me start over.
We're doing it live.
Okay, we're doing it live. Welcome everybody to another review episode of The Mandalorian here on the
Geek
Buddies.
All right, you know what? We underestimated you, Laura. We underestimated you.
Am I part of the club now? Did I earn my? I earned it this time.
Oh, I feel like that's really off. If you can get that part, you're good.
I love it.
Like
yeah.
Everything else after this is just gravy.
Yeah, because awesome. Cal and Elsie, it took him 3 episodes to get it. You got it right off the bat. So much love to you, Laura Kelly. To your faction mate there, Kalinowski. But thank you all so much for joining us. Shannon McClung, who usually joins us on these reviews, unfortunately has some personal business that he's handling. He will talk about it in his time when he's ready to. But the great and awesome Laura Kelly has decided to join us. She is my co-host on The Jedi Way. She has her own podcast called The Force Toast Pod that she hosts with her friend Alice. There, she is knee-deep in Star Wars lore and was on last week, I think, with Star Wars Explained, Molly and Alex over there breaking down The Mandalorian. So we're very honored and blessed to have her on the show with us to break down this incredible episode, episode 4, The Siege, here, season 2 of The Mandalorian, directed by Apollo Creed himself, Carl Weathers. Doing this thing, or Greef Karga, as some people know him in the show. And on this one, and by the way, before we get go too deep, spoilers.
There it is. Good job,
spoilers,
Johnny.
Spoilers.
You did it. You did it in the right order. Everyone in the YouTube comments is going to be very happy with you.
It only took me 4 episodes to finally get that right in the right order. But anyway, so this one basically is, the Mandalorian needs to get his ship fix something that Laura Kelly has been going crazy about, the Razor's Crest. It's finally now landed. He's back at Navarro, meeting up with Greef Karga and Cara Dune. And they, of course, because this has been a serialized show, they ask him, while the ship's getting fixed, to go on this adventure, to go to what they think is an Imperial base that's kind of skeleton crew, and just kind of put it out of commission so that Greef Karga can have a safe planet. But so much gets revealed in this episode, and we're going to break it all down and talk about it today. First, overall, let's go, Michael, and then Laura. What are your feelings about this episode?
I was just saying before we started it, obviously we all know Ahsoka Tano is coming, and with Bo-Katan sort of dropping that name at the last episode, I knew that she probably wasn't going to appear at all in this episode because Johnny had informed me, like, Dave Filoni is directing next week's. Obviously, he's writing and directing next week's. He wants to do his Ahsoka stuff. But I when it started off and he went back to Navarro, I was a little bit like, all right, let's just get on with it. Like, I'm ready to get, come on, let's just go. I want Ahsoka. But they packed so much into this episode. So many great character moments, such amazing action, so many reveals that, like, it's going to be well worth the wait for Ahsoka, but this was definitely a giant step forward in Mando's mythology, in the mythology of this series. Just so much to talk about. And I think overall impressions, though, I looked at my brother after we watched it and I was like, we literally have a TV show that has Star Wars movie level special effects. Like, that's my main takeaway. Like, yeah. Carl Weathers, like it was all great, amazing directing, but like, these effects, even from season 1, which were really, really strong, to now, are so amazing that we literally have a 30 to 40 minute feature quality movie every week, and it is a joy. Yeah. That is my overall thoughts. We have a ton more to talk about, but yeah, Laura, what did you think?
So I had 2 very different experiences with this episode, because I watched it very early this morning when I was not awake enough, as I learned in retrospect, because when I watched it the second time, I got so much more out of it. I got to take my time a little bit and kind of pause and be like, okay, what are those things in that weird colored
tank?
Yeah. So it's definitely worth going back and watching a second time, especially if you're getting up and watching it before you're fully awake. but I was, I think Carl Weathers had a really hard task ahead of him in this episode. He was kind of in the same position that Bryce Dallas Howard was in last episode, where we were like really gunning to get to the next thing, but we had to like stop and pause and do this whole kind of side mission. Like, we're all very excited to get to Ahsoka, right? Like, Ahsoka is probably going to show up in episode 5, or if she doesn't show up, like, she'll at least be mentioned or something. But so everyone's really excited for that, but we had to sort of step off and do this other thing first. And I think that was probably a huge challenge for him to really deliver when all of us have this like anticipation of let's just get to the next thing. So I think he killed it. I think he did a great job. It was great to see some of our friends like Horatio Sands back in this episode. Yeah. Nice. It was so exciting. I think that there are some really important bits in this episode too. Like we'll kind of dive into some of the details, but like Dr. Pershing's little transmission. Yep.
Like
I had to go back and like pause and just like listen to each thing and write it all down and be like, I'm going to need to remember this because this is going to be important.
Yeah.
So I think there were a few moments like that in the episode, and overall, those little kind of details for someone like me who's really into the nitty gritty and the details and the trivia, this was a huge thrill.
Oh,
really enjoyed it.
And one more thing, kind of as an overall, before we dive in on specifics, so much of Mandalorian in season one and season two has really been about taking the pieces of the original trilogy, taking what happened in Jedi, and sort of like paying homage to like those things. You know, we're on Tatooine, we're in the Mos Eisley Cantina. Cobb Vanth in the first episode talks about the destruction of the second Death Star. Mm. I felt like this episode was one of the first major steps, they've done little things, that is really starting to tie in to the more recent trilogy. They're looking forward to the future. So much of this episode, from obviously what it means that the Empire is doing some cloning and needing some midichlorians, but even like the kid in the classroom that had Rey's haircut, the Rey's hairdo, a lot of talk about the New Republic and what it's like for the New Republic trying to tame the Outer Rim. Like, I just felt like Dave Filoni does such a good job. He did such a good job in Clone Wars of filling out that era of the Star Wars universe. And this, they're now kind of taking a step forward and building these little links towards episodes 7, 8, and 9 that I think ultimately are going to make 7, 8, and 9 better for what they're doing. Kind of filling in some of the gaps that that some of the fans felt maybe weren't really filled in as well.
Yeah.
As they were being made, now they can go back in and sort of build those bridges into stuff that was maybe last minute decisions and make them work better.
Yeah. I want to speak on the things you guys brought up real quickly. First thing, this is, Michael, this idea of the special effects going to that level, pretty incredible stuff. I agree with you. This on the heels of what we heard from Bob Chapek, that they are like just restructuring Disney to really focus on Disney Plus, shows you the kind of money they're going to start filtering into these shows on Disney Plus. And The Mandalorian this season specifically is really a preview to what we're probably going to see in these MCU shows, the kind of film level graphics, film level special effects and what have you. And we all benefit from that. Honestly, each one of these episodes is almost like a mini Star Wars movie within itself, which is pretty incredible. The second thing that I want to talk about is that what the Laura addresses, Laura talking about the specifics and the details. This was a very dense episode for what could have been a filler episode like we saw in episode 2. This was incredibly dense. And to put it in the hands of Carl Weathers, who's not, you know, necessarily the most seasoned director, to have him come in and step in and take this universe over. This is a black director. This is an older director. And he killed it. He understood how to work that script in and the shoots and the shots that he wanted to have there and how he wanted these story elements to line up and connect throughout. And the editing in this episode particularly was fantastic for building up the tension throughout. And then the last thing I want to say is what was incredible about this episode for me, because I echo everything you two said, is all of a sudden we were on a cool little like its own thing. It's got its own, it's doing its own. All of a sudden it's like they threw the doors wide open. They're like, it connects to this, 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 and then this too. And you're just like, holy shit, we're really doing this with the second season in the fourth episode of this show? It just blew me away how much they were willing to connect up into the overall Star Wars mythology. And they brought back midichlorians. I don't know how people are going to feel about it.
But they didn't say the word.
Not in so many words. It's,
we're not going to say it, but you know what we mean.
Was it M count, M factor? What was it?
M count.
I think it was M count, M count.
Yeah. Very sly, Star Wars, very sly. Now, you mentioned some of the sequel trilogy aspects that we're probably tying into, which I think is great. Yeah. However, I did notice a couple of legit, I think they might have actually been like direct lines out of A New Hope. Like they may have actually taken sound bites from A New Hope and stuck them in this episode, specifically with the stormtroopers. They had a couple of lines that I was just like, oh, that sounds familiar. So that was fun. We're tying it back everywhere in every direction, which I really appreciate.
That's what I mean.
It's so great because I'm going to use an example for anyone that loves Rise of Skywalker. You're welcome to love Rise of Skywalker. I'm happy you love it. But like a lot of people, when you talk about that moment when Maz Kanata gives Chewie the medal and you're like, that's fan service. You're calling back something in a way that I feel kind of weird. It's kind of cheesy.
Yeah.
But what Mando does, to your point, Laura, it calls back to everything. Everything is a callback. Everything is a reference, but in such a loving, well thought out way that at no point do I feel like it's actually fan service. I don't feel like they're trying to like sell me on, hey, wink, wink, we're cool like you. It's just they know the world so well that they can do it. To, you know, to Mithral, Horatio Sands' character kind of going out on the ledge to do the thing, just like Obi-Wan does on the Death Star. Like all these little moments, it's just, it's so peppered throughout, and yet it still is building new directions in Star Wars. It's a fascinating thing to me, the way that they can be so aware of all of the other things and call back in a thousand different ways. And yet I still feel each week that I'm getting brand new Star Wars in a way that I didn't always feel like I was getting in the new trilogy.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, let's see. So let's just take it step by step. They, you know, Mando arrives there on Navarro, getting his ship serviced. We see that. Oh, okay.
Well, actually, really quickly, one thing I just want to bring up before we get to Navarro,
it's
I just didn't want to miss
it. Show. Okay. Yeah. Keep going. Yeah.
I think we should go in order. I just want to, in last week's episode, obviously Mando saw a bunch of Mandalorians who took their helmets off.
Yes.
Realized that the him not taking the helmet off was not made necessarily something all Mandalorians did. So I don't think it's by accident that in this episode, after he nearly electrocutes Baby Yoda, he has some soup with him, and we actually do see him lift his mask up and Baby Yoda kind of looking at his face. So I do think that's just interesting to note for everybody, the way that they set up him sort of seeing Mandalorians that didn't take their mask off, finding out that the whole Children of the Watch is not necessarily all Mandalorians, and we're seeing like a slow progression of mask moments. It's a really small moment, but just something I wanted to make sure we mentioned.
I agree.
Now go ahead, please. I didn't want to interrupt.
I was going to mention, you interrupted in the middle of my sentence. I said he was landing on Navarro after Baby Yoda and him had tried to fix this thing and after he had opened his mask. But, you know, Mike, it got to it. So we did touch on it, but I like it. But this idea that they don't understand each other, that's fascinating, too, because he's trying to talk to Baby Yoda, but Baby Yoda does not understand. So why would you let this person weigh into the electronics of your ship if he doesn't understand your language? And I thought it was funny when he was like, it was worth a try. We're seeing Mando open up episode by episode more and more as well, don't you think?
I find him super charming. I think it's really kind of sweet, the idea that he is chosen to protect this child, but he's absolutely not a good father. He is not a good like I think it's adorable. Like I think it does make him sort of kind of cute. Like it's like his protection of the child and the way that he's like, he goes anywhere I go, I'm not going to let him out of my sight, is very protective. Yep. But when it comes to actual like child rearing judgment, not his strong suit.
Yeah, yeah. Well, they land Greef Karga. We find out Greef Karga is like essentially the mayor of the town, and we have this shot before we get the title graphics for the Mandalorian for this episode of Cara Dune beating up these people there and taking back the things that they stole and connecting with that creature there, the little animal there, and then we understand that she's the sheriff of the town now all of a sudden. So this town has been cleaned up, literally cleaned up. Like a Western, cleaned up, and they are like teaching the kids. They're doing all these things. There's like money involved. The Mithril is essentially a tax accountant. This is very interesting stuff happening here. Laura, what did you think about all this once we landed on Navarro and saw what they had done?
Well, there was a farmer's market. So fully gentrified.
Great place to visit.
Navarro, you know, at this point. So that was really kind of fun to see. It was really fun to see that the Aqualish was a return, you know, another reference back to A New Hope.
Right.
So that was sort of interesting to see whatever their deal was. I don't know what the little creatures were. Those may have been new. But they were awfully cute. We saw it in Cara Dune getting to interact with them a little bit. So it was really sweet to get to see how Navarro has very much been cleaned up by, I think Marshall Dune may have been her new title.
Marshall Dune, yes.
I'm not fully sure. Yeah, I'm like, well, what's the sort of, I guess, what's the levels of Brief Karga versus the marshal? I don't know what the.
I feel like he's the mayor of the town and she's the marshal of the town, right? Like,
I think in season one they actually said that Brief Karga was sort of a disgraced magistrate. I think magistrate is actually the proper. Like, I think he's sort of going back to his old ways. So he's magistrate, which is kind of like a mayor. She's marshal. And I do think that little ferret creature was a new thing. I did notice in the closing credits, when you look at the development art, in the development art where Cara Dune was fighting the Aqualish, Aqualish criminals, the little ferret creature was shooting fire out of its mouth. So I think probably at some point it was a fire-breathing ferret, but I think that that got cut. But I would have. But maybe he shoots fire.
No, he does, because if you notice, one of the Aqualish in close-up is burnt. Their face is burnt. So it could have been from trying to capture that little creature or what have you. So thank God Kara didn't get too close. Thank God the creature liked Kara, Marshall Dune, or else she would have been burnt up as well. So, then we step out of this and, you know, we see that creature on the port there who is going to take care of Mando's ship, kind of gives the look, holds the look longer. So we know that's going to lead into
this guy.
There it is. This is what happens when Michael drinks after 5:30. We get the signals. But then it goes into, we hear from Grief. We meet the Mithril again, all over again. And his little exhale of gas was really funny as well when he saw Mando there. But was he trying to get him in trouble by saying that ship is not registered? Blah, blah, blah. So what do you think the relationship is there amongst all three of them?
I mean, I took it at pretty much face value, which is the reason that Mithral had a bounty on him in the first place was apparently because he cheated Grief Karga. He's now paying that off, and Mando scares the shit out of him. I took the little exhalation of air as his race's version of, like, pissing his pants.
Laura?
I would buy into that. I think that's accurate. You know, I'm having this weird thing right now with Grief Karga where I'm questioning a little bit whether or not he's fully loyal to Mando. It's not so much to do with Mithral, but it's more to do with his best guys that he put on the job to fix the Razor Crest. Mm-hmm. And then we find out at the end that one of them is a spy. And so I'm like, well, if this person is actually someone that Grief Karga would vouch for, which who knows? Maybe it's not. Maybe he's just, a figure of speech calling him one of his best people. I question a little bit. I'm like, do we fully trust Grief Karga at this point? Is he really trustworthy? Like, he seemed to have proved himself in the season finale of season one, but I'm like, I don't know. I'm not sure.
I mean, I think he even says, even him getting rid of the Imperials, Grief Karga's not a hero by any stretch. He's not fighting the rebellion. He's not part of the New Republic. I mean, he goes out of his way to make a point that he's not part of the New Republic. Yeah. He wants to get the Imperials out of Navarro so that Navarro can become like a huge trade port. He wants to make money. He's looking to be... So I think he is very loyal to Navarro, and I think he's loyal to his own success.
Right.
But that success, to your point, could absolutely not include Mando and could absolutely include betraying Mando. So I think he's definitely someone to like keep your eye on in that respect.
Right.
A couple other things that I really did like, though, in addition to Navarro's fabulous new farmer's market.
Yes.
I really, really liked, it's a kind of a blink and you'll miss it, but they also put up a beautiful statue of IG-11 in the background.
Did.
If you can see, like, they put a lovely statue of IG-11 to commemorate his sacrifice. It was lovely. So, I really did like how through the farmer's market, the citizens of Navarro wearing brighter colors, it being generally a little bit sunnier and less foggy, just the entire vibe of Navarro, they definitely went out of their way to go, it's a kinder, gentler, happier place, which I thought really was quite lovely.
Before we get into the meat of the episode, which is this adventure and the going to the Imperial base, what do you think about Baby Yoda and the exchange with the young kid there and his blue macaroons, essentially? Baby Yoda taking the macaroons. The kid said no, but Baby Yoda once again taking what he wants, like the eggs, like the macaroons. This is a dangerous behavior, especially as we find out later what they're using his blood for. Thoughts?
Laura?
Honestly, I just kind of play it off as like, childish precociousness. I'm not really looking into it too deeply, I think, from that in that aspect. But I do think the kid probably made a smart move when he saw that Baby Yoda could use the, you know, his mind to move the cookies from one desk to the other to not cross him. I think that probably could have gone a little bit darker if they had crossed that bridge, but I think, you know, they stopped just short of that, and I think it was that's how I read it. Just more precociousness than more so than anything that's inherently evil.
Okay.
I think there's actually a really good structural reason why we had to have that moment there. Not necessarily stealing the macaroons, but this is the first time, like we do later in the episode, as Laura said, we have Dr. Pershing kind of talking about the M count and the idea that one of the reasons that Baby Yoda was important is because he is strong in the Force. And we actually haven't seen Baby Yoda use the Force yet this season. So in a very structural sense, it's a nice reminder for the audience that, oh yeah, he's got the Force. That's why they need him. So I think it was important in this episode to find a moment to do it. I think it's great that they did it in a nice little comedic bit. So I do think that's good. And then also, the other thing that it's fascinating, and I had to go back and watch it a couple times, is while all of that's going on with Baby Yoda and the blue macaroons, you've got this protocol droid who is the teacher of the class, literally laying out a bunch of like Star Wars nerd facts for anybody who cares to listen. They're talking about all the hyperspace trade routes. They drop Corellia. They drop Coruscant. They're talking about how Coruscant used to be the capital of the Old Republic and the Empire, but Chandrila is currently the new location for the capital for the New Republic. So like, there's just like, if you are a Star Wars nerd and we're talking about Easter eggs, going back and listening to the protocol droid's lessons, what you can hear while all of this other action is going on, it's all a bunch of information. And I think one of the more important pieces, even though it doesn't sound like it, is that the protocol droid is talking about how their galaxy is made up of the core worlds, the mid-rim, the outer rim, the expansive regions, the deep core, and then the unexplored regions. And the only reason this is kind of interesting is because this is also the episode where we're dropping these clones, which seems to be a reference to, you know, the First Order and Snoke and Palpatine, and they were all off in those unexplored regions, which is why nobody knew what they were doing for 30 years. So as we start to, as I was saying before, as we start to look forward to those ties to the First Order, Starkiller Base, all of those plans that get into the new trilogy, even though this is just a protocol droid listing off like nerdy Star Wars facts, it's another way that they're starting to try and like build those bridges into here's what the old trilogy was and here's what the new trilogy was, which I thought was really fascinating.
Yeah, are they essentially going the Clone Wars route, where the Clone Wars saved the prequels from the criticism that it endured? Is essentially Mandalorian going to try to save this last set of movies, this last trilogy of movies, from some of the mistakes they've made here? You sense that?
That's an interesting thought.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think absolutely. I mean, you know, I went back leading up to Rise of Skywalker and rewatched the prequels, and I hadn't watched them since I had like seen them years before, because I was not the biggest prequel fan.
Right.
So when I watched the prequels originally, not my faves. Then I watched all of Clone Wars, became a super nerd about that era of Star Wars, and went back and watched the prequels. And even though there's still a lot of stuff, like Hayden Christensen's acting, that just does not stand the test of time, I enjoyed them more. Because what Dave Filoni and all the writers and producers and artists and on the Clone Wars did is they brought out aspects of that world and made them cooler.
Yeah.
And I do think that what we are seeing now in Mando Season 2 is the very beginnings of Filoni and Favreau and the Mandalorian team starting to take some of those gaps that exist in 7, 8, and 9 and starting to fill in some pieces that are ultimately 30 years down the road, when someone goes back and watches all these in order, going to make those movies even stronger. Like, I think that we're absolutely seeing the beginnings of that right now.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, so let's get into the episode. Let's get into the rest of the episode here. They recruit him, Mando, to go, of course, because every episode he's getting recruited into one adventure or another. He's getting recruited in this one by his old friends to go and go to this Imperial base and shut it down. And all they end up, you know, Mando ends up helping them get in after they're having trouble get in. They get in and shoot some troopers, and then they find out what is actually happening here. And that's the moment of the show for me, is when you see these essentially tubes that are used for cloning, a la Alien Resurrection, a la so many things that you've seen in the past before. They're having these tubes, and it looks like, if you slow it down and you brighten up the screen a little bit, you can tell there are shades of Snoke in the face and the head structure, the scar, the small ear, all of that. And then we get to what Laura mentioned earlier, is that hologram giving us the message that we find out was from only 3 days ago. Mando thinking Moff Gideon was dead. He's still alive now. That's a revelation for the Mandalorian. So what that all means. So we're seeing here now that they are trying to clone essentially Snoke or Palpatine, in connection to Palpatine, using Baby Yoda, a.k.a. the child's blood. This is a massive revelation. What's your reaction to this? Laura, let's start with you.
Oh, you know, when I first watched it, I didn't even really notice all the snakes in a Snoke's in a tank. Snakes on a plane, Snoke's in a tank, yeah.
Sam Jackson starring in a Snoke's in the Tank movie, I'm here for, so 100% in.
Oh, they played the Snoke scores or notes.
Yes, they did.
Score when you got to the close up. Anyway, go ahead, Laura.
Yep.
No, I was going to say the second time I watched it, that was what I caught, and I that was my first sort of thought, was like, oh, this is the Snoke theory that maybe doesn't suck. So I think this is a big reveal. I totally agree that this might actually be something. I think we saw similar tanks in The Rise of Skywalker on Exegol, if I recall. So yes. We're pulling the rhyming from all different directions again. Yep. But mm-hmm. That was my theory too. That's the running theory I've seen on Reddit. And mm-hmm. I think that I would be willing to bet that's the direction we're headed in.
Yeah. I mean, look, Dr. Pershing in season one, when he first showed up, every Star Wars nerd in the world saw that the patch on his shirt was the same patch that workers on Kamino wore mm-hmm. in the prequels. And Kamino is the clone planet that built all the clones for the Clone Wars.
Right.
So we knew from season one that there was clone aspects involved. We didn't know why. There's a lot of thoughts that, is Baby Yoda a clone of Yoda? Like, there was a lot of questions, but cloning was always in the mix. So having him show up now, while we have these clone tanks, saying they needed something with a high M count. And in addition to that, I was kind of like snooping around online. And although I didn't read it, apparently in the Rise of Skywalker novelization, they actually do make the point that cloning Palpatine's body was not the issue that that the Sith followers were having. They could clone his body, but they couldn't clone the Force.
Right.
And so the fact that that is in the novelization, that it's in the world, that like that was the issue with Snoke/Palpatine, and that we now have Baby Yoda, like, this seems like a no-brainer to me. Like, I would be shocked if they were going in any other direction. Like, this seems to be, this is the answer, and this all, kind of to Laura's point, this is the less shitty version of Snoke. Like, you're now building the backstory that none of us ever got, that now is going to make all of it make more sense and make it more enjoyable to watch 7, 8, and 9.
I hope they... It's dangerous territory, but I trust them to walk it correctly for sure. And I'm seeing now, I'm seeing from some other people, they're calling them strand casts. So not clones exactly, but bioengineered organisms. So that's what they aren't as easy to work as clones. So it's clearly a very difficult job that he's got going on here. But look, we had Boba Fett right in the first episode, possibly.
Do we, John?
95%. Do we? I say 95% yes, but 5% no. I hold back a little bit. And we talk about clones. We talk about Jango Fett. You talk about Kamino. We talk about all this. And here comes cloning again in this episode. So what are we leading to? You know, Laura and I were talking about this on the Jedi Way, and I said they are bringing all these people in all these episodes to set up some final massive battle where everybody comes together. By the way, we have Marshall Cobb Vanth now and Marshall Cara Dune. That's interesting too. What's that going to lead to? So all of these things are happening, and I don't know what position Ahsoka Tano has on that planet they're heading to next, but this is all so fascinating. And then of course we get to the M count moment, saying that, which is essentially a shortening of the word midichlorians. Now remember, Anakin Skywalker apparently tested off the charts at 20,000 midichlorians, more than Master Yoda at 9 years old. So there was potential for him to be using. What's the number that Baby Yoda or the child is at, for God's sakes? That's what I need to know. Through
you know,
the roof.
I'm a little bit concerned about the Ahsoka, the fact that we're banking on Ahsoka being in the next episode, because if they've got a tracking beacon on the crest, which I'm jumping ahead, I'm sorry. Little bit concerned that, like, if they're trying to seek out material for cloning and they find out that he's headed towards a Jedi, is there going to be a confrontation at some point there?
Yeah. I hadn't even thought of that. Oh, my God. Yeah. Woo! Mike, what did you feel about them bringing him in a cloak? You know, look, Mike and I went to see Phantom Menace together in 1999. I think it was.
We saw all of them together. Yeah.
Tallahassee Mall, sitting outside waiting in Florida to get our tickets. We went together to go see it, and that's where we were introduced to midichlorians. Certainly, there was a lot of debate amongst our nerd friends coming out of that movie about midichlorians, and here they rear their head again. Ugly or not is your perspective. What did you feel about it, Mike? Do you think this is the wise path to take? Because it divided the fandom.
I have friends who worked on Clone Wars and Rebels, and I've kind of asked them about this, and I've said, did you guys just go through with Clone Wars and just fix everything that was horrible? And they don't look at it that way. Like, the way that most people who work on the Clone Wars look at it, which is how Dave Filoni thinks about it as well when you hear him in interviews, is... they look at what George Lucas did as, like, this is the gospel, and you did what you did. And what they look at what they do is they take what George Lucas's intentions were and they just keep going in that direction and flesh them out even further. So we all, I think resoundingly, like I would say the majority of Star Wars fans, not the biggest fans of the idea of midichlorians. But
yeah.
I will say that a lot of times it's more about the execution than the idea.
Sure.
And in Phantom Menace, just dumping out this idea, hey, this is the Force version of baby Jesus. Mm. There's no father. The midichlorians made him. He's the chosen one. You're kind of like, what? I don't get it. I don't like this. In the terms of what Mandalorian is doing, which is just basically saying, hey, baby Yoda, super strong in the Force. We want to use that and use that force power to make the Emperor, and you're using midichlorians as the term of measurement, it kind of makes it less hokey, I guess. Mm-hmm. Like, when you use midichlorians to do, like, the baby Jesus story, hokey. When you do midichlorians to say, super strong in the Force, we want to use this clone to make a new Emperor, you're like, yeah, okay, cool. Like, I just feel like they go through and recontextualize. This is what Clone Wars Animated was all about. I feel like Mando is now starting to get into this territory, too. It's recontextualizing some of the silly parts of a world that we love and making it less silly so that we can all enjoy it together.
Okay. All right. Laura, what you feel about
that? Now, I'll say that I do like that you bring up the point of recontextualizing it for a certain group of fans that may not have been as big of fans of the prequel. However, there was an entire generation who, the prequels are their Star Wars.
True.
100% true. 100% true.
You know, they have no problem with the fact that the midichlorians were put out there and they just accepted it and that's how it is.
Yeah.
And because I was sort of, a latecomer to the Star Wars fandom, it's been so ingrained in the entire process for me that I don't question it. I don't think it's, you know, I never once have ever thought, like, oh, that's dumb. I don't like how they're changing that. But, you know, and that's just me. And so, but I think that they're not, you know, they're not making anything worse. They're not changing anything for that group of fans.
True.
But the fact that they're recontextualizing it for another group of fans that don't think the same way is really interesting. It's a really interesting strategy for storytelling, and I'm super into it.
Yeah,
I agree. Actually, it's so funny. You know, I mean, honestly, like, this is the ultimate, like, it's the Star Wars quote. Like, Star Wars, how you view any aspect of Star Wars, it's all from a certain point of view. You know, it's all like, it's all very much like, when did you come on board and what was your version of it? And then the stuff that came later, what did you think of it? Mm-hmm. But then you start, like, cause I know, like, I mean, Johnny and I have a lot of friends who are of our generation who kind of grew up with the original, loved it. And then the prequels came out and didn't like it. And that was the end of it for them. And they've never gone and watched Clone Wars Animated. They've never gone and dived into all that stuff. And so when you do really go through and experience that, it does change it. And I think, kind of to your point, there's a whole generation of people. I have tons of friends who love Star Wars, and their love is they grew up watching the prequels.
Yep.
And we've always argued about it, and Clone Wars kind of brought us together. And I kind of feel like Mando is going to do that same thing with some of these aspects and some of the plots of what's happening currently in Star Wars in the movies.
What a novel concept to bring people together for Star Wars instead of dividing people in the Star Wars fandom. Let's hope it continues. I'd like that.
We love to see it.
Yeah. And Laura, do you think that a lot of these clones who end up being in the stands there in Exegol at the end of Rise of Skywalker, do you think it's all those clones in the robes?
The dark choir. Yeah. I do wonder about that. I'm just, where did all those people come from?
And where what did they come from?
Where is their fresh water for all of them? I would love to know. But yeah, I'd be curious to know if we're going to end up in the unknown regions at some point in The Mandalorian, if we're actually going to get to witness that part of the galaxy would be really cool. And really tie it all back together to the sequel trilogy. Right. It would be interesting to see. I would venture to guess that we're not going to get there this season. Right. If we get there at all, it would probably be subsequent season.
It would be amazing to see if they actually went all the way there. Like if they can do that, I mean, that's a big, that's a big chunk of story to bite off and try and handle. But I mean, like maybe they will. Who knows?
Well, I mean, I think they bit off a lot in this episode. You know, and you know, shout out to Carl Weathers again. I mean, his action sequences are incredible here, but this moment in the episode is one of horror. It is a terror moment, absolutely horror. When they discover what they've been using the child's blood for and what they've been creating, and the way those tanks are illuminated, it's not like the Bantha tank where it has this bright lights and you can see everything. This is like dark, very dark. You can barely make it out. And Mando's like, the child, he gets in, you know, they figure out he's got to go in his jetpack, go and try to save the child, because they might be trying to take the child from him, and leaves Greef Karga and Cara Dune and the Mithril are there to fight off the stormtroopers on the base as they make their way out and try to escape. But that moment is a moment of terror and horror. And so shout out to Carl to be able to grab that moment so well and make it work within the scope of the episode here on The Mandalorian. All right, so as I said, he takes off to go and save the child. They're stuck there and they have to fight their way out. There's some fun stuff, fun back and forth between Cara Dune and Carl Weathers. And look, we got to bring it up. I watched it with a little bit of like, you know, kind of just like, damn, because of some of the stuff that Gina Carano has said on her social media, what have you. There were some great moments between him and Greef Karga that had another layer of like disappointment on my end, because she's doing a really good job with this character. And I thought she had nice moments with Carl Weathers in these scenes, and the Mithril, I can't say it anyway.
Mithril
as well. But it's heartbreaking.
We got you.
Yeah, thank you. But it's heartbreaking to see that this is an element to it as well. Did that come up for you guys, or did you just kind of focus on the show?
Honestly, I had a moment in this episode where I thought about Russell Crowe. And I'll tell you why.
Oh, this is going to be good. I know
it
is.
I'm going to hear this.
So I kind of thought the same thing as you. Like, I'm watching the episode.
No one threw a phone here, man. All right.
Well, but this is my thing, is that, like, I was watching the episode, and I agree with you. I think Gina Carano does a good job as Cara Dune. Yeah. I like the character of Cara Dune. I like the idea of Cara Dune. I like this rebel fighter who was from Alderaan.
Yeah.
Like everything about her is really interesting. In the middle of it, I'm kind of having the, Gina Carano on Twitter. She's on Parler now, blah, blah, blah. So then I thought to myself, look, I think Russell Crowe's a great actor. We all pretty much know he's an asshole. I love Christian Bale as Batman. We've all heard the video of him having a meltdown on set. Sure. Like, Gina Carano's, the reason people aren't liking her right now is very specifically politically motivated, which is very what we're all dealing with right now. But there are lots of actors and actresses who I think are very good at what they do, who I'm pretty sure are fucking horrible people in real life.
That's fair.
So I kind of chalked it up to, I'm having a feeling about this, but let me put this aside, because as an actress doing her job, she's doing a good job with this. So I'm not going to say I didn't think about it. It occurred to me, but I kind of thought through it for a minute, and that was my process of kind of being like, I'm going to put this away for a minute, and I'm going to enjoy what's happening here in universe.
All right. What do you feel about it? Did you have any issues with that, Laura, as you were watching the episode?
I think I had a harder time putting it aside than Michael did. So it's one of those things where I knew she was going to be back. I knew that it was going to come in this episode. You know, the minute he said that they were going to be going back to Navarro, that totally checked out. And it's just, it's so hard because you're right. The character's so cool. The fact that we have this like history of Alderaan and the fact that she was a drop trooper, like these are all really cool details that make up a really cool character. But you know, the fact that she's, some of the ideas she's promoting are actually dangerous. I mean, if you're a shitty person and you're, if you're a good actor and a shitty person, but you're not really saying anything that's endangering anyone's lives that I can hear or that we can hear on Twitter, then that's one thing. But the fact that, you know, she's sort of whistling a different tune in that aspect. So
no, I mean, that's a good point. That's a good point.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm having a hard time reconciling it. And I really wish I wasn't. I wish I could just look past it and just enjoy it for what it is. But I'm struggling with that. And I do think it was really interesting that Vanity Fair put that article out today, of all days, the day that, of, you know, talking about these, you know, these things that Gina Carano is saying and the fandom's reaction to it. I thought that was a really interesting choice that that article came out today. When I first saw that on Twitter this morning, before I'd actually watched the episode, I thought, oh, maybe this is the episode where they're going to kill her off. Because now it just, nothing matters anymore. And that's why she talks the way she talks and doesn't have any problem saying the things that she says.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was interesting. I'm glad that that article came out. I kind of hope that it gets a little bit wider reach than what we're seeing on Twitter, because my impression is that the things that she's saying are very, they're only reaching a very small population.
Right, the
fact that now it's been, she's sort of been exposed to a bigger audience is, I think, it's encouraging for me, and hopefully that this won't have to be an issue for much longer for those of us who aren't adjusting very well to her being back.
That's fair. You know, we talked about it on the previous episode of Jedi Way. Before I'd seen anybody speculate that, I imagined that she was going to be killed off, which is why she's talking all this stuff. But by the end of the episode, I didn't feel that way. And we'll get to that. So we'll talk about that in just a second. All right. So this all happens. They fight their way out. They get onto that cruiser, which we've seen in other pieces of Star Wars, but
the
not
Marauder.
That often. The Marauder. I love the fact they said black market. In my mind, I thought about a nerdy guy finding that and going to sell it on eBay or something like that. So it kind of connected for me in my mind how people sell Star Wars stuff as well. But they fight their way out, and we get an awesome action sequence here, you know, with the speeder bike stuff, which is a Return of the Jedi reference. The two guys slamming into each other and blowing up shows the incompetence of stormtroopers no matter what they're doing. But then we get an all, and then the TIE fighters come, sweet Mary, mother of God. So go ahead, Mike.
we had seen in the trailer, you had seen that moment where the speeder bikes kind of like jumped off the edge of a cliff and went down, and it was awesome. Badass. And as badass as that was in the trailer, it more than delivered in the actuality of the moment. I mean, kind of having like this giant marauder that they like take off a cliff, land on Mithral's land speeder, destroying that and like take off. And you get this canyon chase that is a speeder bike chase that then kind of segues into a TIE fighter chase.
Yeah.
Like with like the stormtrooper getting off of his speeder bike, getting on top of the marauder. Like there was just so much going on. It was such an amazingly well-staged action sequence where you had all of this different action going on. And to Carl Weathers' credit, it's kind of to your point, like everything tracked. It was easy to watch what was going on. This is where I really had that, holy shit, I'm looking at a movie on TV. Like this was like, this is a TV show. And most movies don't have stuff that looks this good. It was 1,000% thrilling. Like I was blown away.
Yeah, what'd you think about this whole chase scene, Laura? We had some New Hope references too, with Carl getting into the, you know, getting into the pit to shoot out from the back of the ship there. What'd you think?
Yeah, I mean, he's pretty brutal in that gunner position. He shoots from the scout troopers at point blank range, which that was fun to see. You know, you're totally right. We got to shout out Carl Weathers, because I think one of my favorite moments of this entire chase sequence was the very beginning when they're going off of the cliff. There's not a whole lot of dialogue in that moment. It's really just the way that, like, the comedic timing of it, the way that it's staged, it's just, it's so fun and it's so funny. And then you're right, it leads into this amazing like action thrill, this thrilling action sequence that was just so fun to watch. It was a really thrilling scene overall. And I think that, I wonder if he's going to get the credit that he's due in this situation, because he really knocked it out of the park. Loved it.
Exactly. And like any great action scene, it builds upon itself, right? The foundation of the first is getting out of the base and going all the way down, slamming into that speeder and rolling down. So you escape. That's the first part of it. Okay, now we've got speeder bike. All right, the speeders are coming, blah, blah, blah. Now we get us. Now we got TIE fighter. So it just, the way it was constructed was just so smart.
Yeah.
And then leading into a final battle sequence with Razor Crest knocking out those last two TIE fighters.
I was going to say, one of the things that was great about the way this was all staged is, look, at the end of the day, if you have a thrilling action sequence with Mandalorian and the child, you're 99% sure they're going to survive.
Yeah,
like maybe you're a little bit worried, but by taking these three characters, kind of to your guys' point about the Gino Carano of it all in general, but Cara Dune, Greef Karga, and Mithral, I really had a moment, especially when they got out of the canyon and the gun was destroyed.
Oh yeah,
and you have these TIE fighters. I really had a moment where I was like, do they go down? Like, I don't know how the TIE fighters have a clear shot. Like, I don't know what happens. And I really did have a moment where I was like, there was actual stakes in jeopardy. Yeah. And then to have the Razor Crest just kind of like swoop in fully repaired in its full glory for the first times in multiple episodes and just have this gorgeous, this gorgeous air battle. It was thrilling. It was great. It was amazing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So they, you know, the kid is not taken. They finally, when they shoot those two TIE fighters out of the sky, Razor Crest lands and the kid abruptly vomits out some of the macaroon, the blue juice, which is perfect. That's going to be a great gift. You know that gift. People are going to use that gift till the end of time. This is a great gift for there. and then everything settles down. Yeah, everything settles down and we get the appearance of Captain Teva again, who is like, taking notes like a policeman, almost like a scene of Law and Order, taking notes and asking some questions of Greef Karga about what happened. And Karga with his leg up on the desk, totally chilling, giving some shady answers. And the Mithral gives him a look and says, what do you want me to do? Then Captain Teva goes out and has another conversation. This is a pretty poignant conversation with Cara Dune out there, with Gina Carano out there, and talks about Alderaan, says he served. And Alderaan asks if she lost anyone. She said, I lost everyone. And then throws that awesome thing on the table there.
The New Republic symbol.
Yeah, the symbol there. And that's a pretty powerful thing. Asks Cara to come be with them, and then mentions some of the people in the central worlds don't believe what's going out here in the outer, and they don't want to believe what's happening, but yeah, we know something's happening here. That's a big, big reveal.
I think with Cara Dune's character, there is sort of this like getting her to kind of come into the New Republic, come back to whatever. But yeah, I really like this idea that in the core worlds, Coruscant being literally the center of the galaxy, the core worlds, they're like, yay, Empire's gone, New Republic is here, bad guy's gone. Right. And on the Outer Rim, you have Captain Teva saying kind of like, yeah, like, these things aren't coincidences. Like, there's some shit going on. And this is what I was talking about. This is that idea that, like, this is the beginnings of the First Order. Like, we are seeing these remnants of the Empire kind of flailing around trying to figure out what's going on. And, like, we know that ultimately 30 years from now, they're going to be successful.
Yeah, yeah. Laura, what'd you think about this scene and what was revealed in the interactions here?
You know, it left me with some questions. One of them is she calls him Blue at one point. Is that a nickname? How friendly are they? Like, I'm curious to know, like, how well they actually know each other. The little chip that he gives her, what exactly was that? I mean, do you think it was, like, some sort of communication device so she can get in touch? Or, like, what was it?
I felt like it was just, like, sort of like a, hey, here's, like, a New Republic insignia that you can, like, I don't know, like, trade with your friends. Like, I don't know what you do with
it. Yeah, like, it'll match your tattoo, so there's that.
Yeah, some people are speculating that it's a New Republic badge, and that she may become a space cop in the future. I've seen that, so some of the speculation is, so maybe that's something. And so maybe, Laura, what we spoke about on Jedi Way, where we thought she might get killed off, she might just go off with the New Republic by the end, and then Mando never sees her again or rarely sees her down the road. That's a way to also kind of write her off the show that isn't necessarily killing the character off and keeping her being some kind of character that people can enjoy and have her be iconic with that character. So that seems like that's what they were setting up here, the idea of her going off with the New Republic to do something bigger, you know?
Yep.
It's a strategy I would definitely accept if they're just going to, you know, as much as I would love to just see like a really violent death scene, I don't think we're going to get it. I have a feeling they're not going to go that direction, but my buddy Eric on Twitter, he hosts the Living Force podcast, and he mentioned like first thing this morning, it was like the first tweet I saw when I opened Twitter, that is the perfect opening to get rid of this, you know, you've got a toxic actor yeah. in your franchise. This is the perfect opening to get rid of her. Have her take off with the New Republic and on a new adventure that we don't yeah. have to see in any kind of spinoff series that yep. I don't want to hear about.
And heroic.
I do think that, yeah, it would be a good strategy to send it off.
It will be.
Here's hoping.
Yeah.
It'll be interesting to see because, look, when season two was filmed, by the time they finished shooting on season two, Gina Carano had not reached the Gina Carano levels that she is currently at on social media. So,
agreed.
Everything that we're seeing in season two sort of predates that. I think that it's going to be season three, where, assuming that Cara Dune survives season two. So we'll see how season two rolls out. Assuming she does, I think season three is where you're going to really see them start to, whatever feelings they have about it, and however they are choosing to handle it, season three is where we're going to see the results of what we are seeing now on social media.
Yeah, and I also think that if you do, send her off with the New Republic to be, part of that, the Resistance, to fight or whatever it is, not Resistance necessarily, but go off to kind of police the universe or the galaxy, you can create media off the character of Cara Dune without necessarily attaching it to
exactly.
Gina Carano, right? In the books, in the comic books, whatever, it doesn't have to be Gina Carano that you think of after a while. It's just Cara Dune, the character. So it's,
right.
Seems like a smart way. Well, before we wrap up, we got to move to the next part of this thing, and that is Moff Gideon, or I forget the person on the base there who speaks to the guy who drops a homing beacon into the Razor's Crest. She goes up there and talks, once again, American accent all over these things, Laura, goes
right?
up there and talks to Moff Gideon and says to Moff Gideon what had happened and that they planted this thing on the Razor's Crest, the tracking beacon, and Moff Gideon is there, and it looks like he is standing amongst some dark troopers. This was a hell of a reveal as well. I mean, as if we didn't have enough in this episode, now this last kind of sequence in this episode reveals the possibility of dark troopers. Michael, you were talking about this earlier. Do you want to mention what this might be?
I don't know what the fuck a dark trooper is, but I looked it up. Because usually with, Pershing shows up, he starts talking about M counts. There's a symbol from Kamino, like, is good. Like, I got off of that and I was like, what the fuck was those? What were those? So I actually had to look it up. And yeah, so apparently in the game Dark Forces, which now this is all part of like Star Wars Legends territory, stuff that's not officially canon anymore. The Empire was attempting to create a legion of highly skilled droid soldiers. In the Dark Trooper Project, and they are highly dangerous and have Beskar-beating, Force-wielding exoskeletons and are potentially Force-sensitive, potentially using Baby Yoda's DNA. Like, whatever. like, there's a lot of potentials. No one seems 100% clear on what these are, but it is clear that whatever Moff Gideon is standing around, they are going to be badass and they are going to be dangerous and they can kick anyone's butt. And here's what makes me very excited about this. In animation, when Ahsoka Tano shows up, you have that moment where Ahsoka Tano does something and you're like, that is why you're Ahsoka Tano. Ooh. And I really hope that Mando gets attacked by these things and they're too much for him. And then she shows up and just fucking wails on them. I don't know if that's going to happen, but in my little geek heart, that's what I want to see.
I like that idea. Laura, any thoughts on these dark troopers?
You are more educated on what they are than what I was. I really had no idea.
I was not until a few hours ago.
Got it. That's fair. But I saw all the hoses and I was just like, are they pilots? I don't know what I'm looking at. Like that was confusing. But my first thought was that they were some sort of battle droid. That was kind of where my brain went at first. So I'll be curious to see them in action. But I love the idea of Ahsoka being involved and however they're revealed.
Yeah, I was right with you. Like, I saw them and I was like, droid army. Like, that's sort of my level of like Star Wars. I was like, are these like old school battle droids from the Clone Wars? Like, that's kind of what I was thinking it was. And it wasn't until I kind of like went and dove in and kind of read some stuff and I was like, oh, okay, this is like, because for me, even like this past week when we were talking about kind of the history of Mandalore and the Mandalorians, someone in the YouTube comments was talking about, well, no, this predates the history. This is the original history. And I was like, well, that's Star Wars Legends. And like, so that's all sort of like the vague. It's
not canon.
It's not canon, but it sometimes can. What's great about Filoni and his team on Clone Wars, and now what's great about Favreau and Filoni and the team on this, is they get to decide. Like, Grand Admiral Thrawn was not canon anymore. until he became canon in Rebels. And they have the ability to take these aspects, whether it be the Old Republic or these Dark Troopers, and they're able to kind of pick and choose these pieces that people love from the old games, the old novels, the old comics, and bring them into this new sort of timeline, this new canon, and make them part of the new canon. And it does seem like what's going on with Moff Gideon on his Star Destroyer is kind of going to go down that road, which I think is super cool. And it's always fun for me, as much of a Star Wars nerd as I am, to have those parts that someone else schools me on, and they're like, oh, well, you don't know, that's this thing from this. Like, I love it. It makes me happy. It's such a dense universe, and that's part of what I love about it.
Yeah, exactly. Exploring it all. You mentioned Star Wars Dark Forces. That is non-canon at this point, but now these Dark Troopers make it canon. But they did appear in Star Wars Commander, which is canon. And apparently the lab technician, from what I'm reading here from GameSpot, the lab technician in the scene is wearing a coat with the insignia for the Imperial Department of Military Research, which was first mentioned in 1989 in the Star Wars role-playing game they had there. So as you said earlier, Mike, on one of our reviews, Filoni and Favreau are just like, okay, what are we going to grab out of here, grab of that? Like, just a couple of kids dumping out all their Star Wars stuff and, like, picking out what they want to use. And it's working, and they're seamlessly and organically making them work within the universe of The Mandalorian and Star Wars overall.
I think I said this maybe in our first Mando interview for the season, or maybe I didn't and I just thought it, but, like, one of the things that's great about Star Wars is Star Wars kind of, like, built action figures. Like, action figures didn't exist before Star Wars. Yeah. Like, that's it's a famous story. George Lucas got the toy rights. Nobody cared because who buys toys? And then boom. And so growing up, that's what you did. You took your Star Wars toys and you just made up all these adventures in your bedroom. And what's amazing and fun about Mandalorian, in the best possible way, is it feels like Bryce Dallas Howard and Carl Weathers and Taika Waititi and Dave Filoni and Jon Favreau and all of them are just, they have a toy box, and they are just mixing and matching and playing, and it's awesome. Like, it's just so much fun.
Yeah, I agree, Laura. All right, so that's everything. Laura, any final thoughts on the episode? Anything we might have missed that you want to talk about?
No, I think we hit everything. Okay. I'm curious to know what these, like, battle droids, how they relate to the Snokes and the tanks. Like, is there any kind of connection there besides Moff Gideon sort of being the bridge? Are we going to see both at some point, or is this just, they're just dropping two Easter eggs, you know, for us to keep an eye on in this episode, and they're going to show up separately. I'll be curious to see. I do think it's going to be, I do think there might be some danger posed for Ahsoka Tano in episode 5, if in fact we do see her, given that Din Djarin is being followed now by Gideon with the tracking beacon. So it's going to be an exciting one to see, I think.
And these Dark Troopers might be Force sensitive as well, so that could be add a whole other element to this thing as well. That they've been in the past in different media have been Force sensitive, so we shall see. Mikey?
Yeah, I'm really curious to see. I mean, we really are. Look, you've got all of these pieces are coming together. Kind of, Johnny, as you said, Boba Fett is a clone. Ultimately,
true.
He's out there in the universe. He also has Mandalorian armor. You've got Moff Gideon with the Darksaber. You've got Bo-Katan coming after him because of the Darksaber. You've got Moff Gideon chasing Mando and the child because he now has the tracking device on it. We know why they wanted the child pretty much, and it really ties to the Snoke First Order stuff. And now we're kind of driving towards Ahsoka Tano. So, like, all of the pieces that they've placed around in this season are all sort of driving together, and I kind of feel like we're in for, like, some fucking crazy-ass episodes coming up. On top of all of that, something else that I'm really intrigued by is the fact, I was just talking with someone about this, thus far in the world of Mandalorian, we've never met somebody who knows Yoda. Like, there's never been a person who looks at the child. There's never been someone who looks at the child and goes, fuck, he looks just like Master Yoda. And Ahsoka Tano obviously knows Yoda. So I'm actually fascinated to see what her reaction to the child is going to be. Like, that's something that I was just like, I've been pondering.
Yeah.
And one more final thing, Dink Ferrick.
Yeah, Dink Ferrick.
Who knew that Dink Ferrick was, like, the motherfucker of the Star Wars world? Like I've never heard Dink Ferrick in my life, and in the past 2 episodes, they've said Dink Ferrick 95 times, and that's going to be my new curse word.
Dank Ferrick.
Is it Dank Ferrick?
Think it's Dank, yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's good because YouTube can't ding us for that. So Dank Ferrick the hell out of this thing. I'm cool with that. Yeah, let us get away with that.
What do you think? What do you think of Rise of Skywalker? Oh, Dank Ferrick.
Dank Ferrick. Dank Ferrick, that choir. I will say one last thing. The way they've set this up, and you guys talk about this, this is the beginnings of the new order. What it may lead to, Han and Leia are out there. This is something, and I have a weird feeling that down the road, and Luke is out there too, that we are going to see something with Han and Leia and Luke as the Mandalorian progresses season to season, because you can't talk about this First Order and not have a way of figuring out who these people are that are eventually going to lead to Kylo and lead to, not Rey necessarily, but certainly Kylo.
Well, I disagree a little bit.
You think we're not going to see them at all?
Look, I think that Mandalorian as a series.
Leia's the general. She's the general. All
right. Well, she's not yet. Right now, she's currently right now, she's currently a populist senator on Chandra, and Han is off doing some.
Someone read Aftermath.
and Bloodline. currently Leia is on Chandra, Han is off racing and doing some things, and Luke is off kind of building his new Jedi Temple. Yeah. I think the reason. Well, A, we won't. I don't think we'll see them because we don't have Carrie Fisher. Potentially we could get Harrison Ford, we could get Mark Hamill. I don't know that we will, but I think that's because what's kind of neat about Mandalorian and kind of Ahsoka Tano as a character is they exist outside of this main story. Like, those characters are in the core worlds, they're living the main world of the galaxy. Mandalorian exists on the outer rim. Mandalorian exists on the edges of the galaxy. Like, look, if Mando went and met up with Han or Leia or Luke, he would be like, hey, the Empire's still out here, I'm fighting Moff Gideon, whatever. They clearly don't know.
Not yet.
And it's pretty well documented in the novels how Leia does ultimately find out.
Yeah,
so
true.
I think that these guys do kind of like they dance through the raindrops. These are the characters that dance through the raindrops of Star Wars and fill in the gaps for us and don't quite meet up with the mainline story. That's my opinion.
Okay. All right. 2 years from now, when Alden Ehrenreich shows up in the fourth season, I'm going to remember this moment.
Totally fair. You know what? I got to give it to you when you are right, because it doesn't happen that often. So I'm always happy to give it to you.
You had to get the shot, didn't you?
Brutal.
That's friendship. All right, everybody. Thanks so much for watching this review of episode 4 here at season 2 of The Mandalorian, The Heist, directed by the great Carl Weathers, written by Jon Favreau. The Siege. I get some things in my head. I got a lot of things in my head. Directed by Carl Weathers, written by Jon Favreau. I think, Mikey, you and I definitely want to thank Laura Kelly for taking the time.
Yes.
For chatting. Thank you, Laura. You are awesome.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Please. It's our pleasure. Where can they find you and everything you have going on, please?
Sure. So you can find me on Twitter. I'm @shutup_Laura. You can find the podcast that I host with my friend Alice, where we drink wine and talk about Star Wars. That's called at Force Toast Pod. It's Force Toast to Star Wars Happy Hour. You can find us any of the places that you find podcasts.
There you go. Mikey.
I am @MKToon on Twitter and Instagram.
And I am @TheRocaSays on Twitter and Instagram. And because Shannon is not here, I got to look up our social media handles real quick. Okay, if you want to follow us on Twitter, it's @geek_buddies. And if you want to follow us on Instagram, it's @the_geek_buddies for all we talk about there. And Mikey, what do we have to tell them?
Look, leave your comments below. We love it, especially on these Mando reviews, because there's so many opinions going on. So leave your comments. Let us know what you thought of this. Let us know what you thought of our opinions. What do you think is happening? What do you think is going to happen in these next episodes of the season? Definitely hit subscribe, like this post, subscribe to the Outlaw page. There's a ton of great stuff. More Geek Buddies, more Jedi Force. What is your guys?
The Jedi Way.
The Jedi Way. I was like, Jedi Force, midichlorians, the Jedi Way. way, if you're listening to this right now on Anchor or Spotify or Apple Podcasts, rate us there, leave some comments. It helps us go up in the rankings. And the best thing that you can do is share this on Twitter, post it on Facebook, text it to your friends. When your friend asks you, what was that walrus face guy in this episode of Mandalorian? You don't have to answer. You can just send them a link to this. It is all good. So this is the way. May the Force be with you. Have an awesome weekend.
Wow, he got it all in there. For everyone, as Mike mentioned, that Laura and I do host a Star Wars show called The Jedi Way here on the Outlaw Nation. That's every couple of weeks you see a new episode from us talking about something from the world of Star Wars. We just dropped our most recent episode a couple days ago, or yesterday actually, about the first three episodes of The Mandalorian, where we thought it was going. So definitely is a fun little companion piece to this review to see of how much we got right or wrong as we walk into this thing. So thank you all so much for watching this or listening to it. If you listen to the podcast feed, we appreciate it greatly. Have a good Thanksgiving. Wear your mask. Do all the positive things you need to do. Don't be peer pressured into not wearing a mask by anyone, your friends or family. Do what you need to do to keep yourself safe. We'll talk to you next time on another review here for The Mandalorian on the
Geek
Buddies.
Hey!